Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. I'd like to welcome in our guest. You've seen her on CNBC. She was the editor-in-chief of USA Today, the Wall Street Journal's Weekend Journal. She's written a bestseller called That's What She Said, What Men and Women Need to Know About Working Together. And she serves as a Yale journalism lecturer. And today, Professor Joanne Lipman is here to chat with us about the FTC's ban on non-compete agreements. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
In April, we covered here on Legal Face-Off the Federal Trade Commission's ban on non-competes, which was set to go into effect on September 4th, so next week. Last week, a Texas judge struck down the ban on the basis that the FTC lacks the statutory authority to enact such a rule and ruled that the agency was arbitrary and capricious in its rulemaking. This decision came after several Texas businesses challenged the rule. Can you tell us more about this decision?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Tina. So, you know, just to step back for a second, if you think about what non-competes are, they have been around for centuries. And in America, they've been around for decades and decades. And it's primarily, just historically, what a non-compete was you've got a top executive or a founder, somebody who has a lot of competitive trade secrets, confidential information. And so the non-compete idea was if they leave, you don't want them to go immediately over to the competitor across the street and share all your confidential information. What's happened and what led, I believe, to this FTC ruling was what you might call non-compete creep, where it started, people started getting these non-compete agreements, not when they were the top executive, but where they were in low-income jobs and even hourly jobs. There were some cases of fast food workers who were subject to these non-competes. They didn't have confidential information, and it really prohibited and restricted them from finding new employment. So that was what led to the FTC's decision. But in turn, then you had the Chamber of Commerce and others saying that the FTC was way overstepping its bounds in banning non-competes. And the Texas court agreed with that.
So what was the basis for that ruling? Why did they say the FTC that this wasn't within their purview, you think?
Well, you know, their ruling was simply that it was stretching beyond the bounds of what is the purview of the FTC. And then the Chamber of Commerce and others, they were arguing that this was harmful because they believe non-competes are good because it prevents big companies that can pay more from picking off founders and picking off people who are starting small businesses. That was their argument.
How does this Texas ruling impact what was supposed to be the effective date of the ban coming up this next week? What does how does the ruling impact outside of Texas? Like, is it enforceable outside of Texas?
Well, so for right now, it is blocked. Right now, it is blocked. But we don't know exactly how this is going to end up playing out. The FTC could appeal. This could end up going to the Supreme Court if that goes all the way up. You know, there's other ways that this can go where this may not be final, but for right now they're stymied. But it's interesting because other state courts have ruled in other directions, right? There was a ruling in Florida that agreed that this ban is invalid, but there had been a previous ruling back in July, where there was a finding that, the FTC was correct, that non-competes are not justified. So this may not be the end of the story.
So there are other states, as you mentioned, there are five states that ban non-compete agreements. What about those and how will this ruling affect those? And let's start with that.
Yeah, so it doesn't affect your state, the state rules. And there are a lot of state rules. You already have five states that ban non-competes. You have other states that are restricting non-competes. I think what's really interesting here that we can talk about just briefly is who would be impacted by this ban on non-competes. It's interesting. It's not as cut and dried as you might think, right? So by what the Texas ruling does by saying you can still have non-competes, basically the FTC can't ban them. The class of workers that's really going to be impacted most is going to be your lower income workers, your hourly workers. There's some stunning research on this that shows that 30 million workers, which is 20% of all workers, have been subject to non-compete clauses. And clearly, they are not all top executives who have secret confidential information. There is other research that showed 12% of workers earning less than $20,000 a year have been subject to non-competes. 15% of workers without college degrees have been subject to these non-competes. And if these non-competes stay in force, those are the people who are really going to be most impacted. When we're talking about like these high income, the people with the secrets, that it doesn't actually impact them because very few people kind of have focused on this. But in the original FTC rule, there was a carve out for these very high income people who had policy making decisions, who made over $151,000 a year. They weren't impacted by this. You could still have the non-competes. So, oh, and by the way, the FTC doesn't even regulate. They don't have jurisdiction over certain industries, including things like banking and SNLs. So they were not impacted either by this potential FTC ruling.
So, Professor, I mean, inevitably, these issues rely heavily on, you know, political views, right? I mean, the FTC chairperson was appointed by Democrat. Texas is a, you know, state that is run by Republicans. What's the logic, aside from just pure politics, what's the logic, for example, Texas uses in explaining why they would ban this or overturn this ban when, to your point, it so inordinately affects lower income workers?
Yeah, I think that, you know, basically they're just looking at FTC overreach. This is a not surprising Republican perspective, right, which is we want less government and the FTC should not have massive reach in order to have a federal ban on the non-compete laws. So it's just that, you know, that clearly there's a difference in the politics there. But again, we'll see how this all ends up. I don't know that this is the absolute final word.
And do we think the upcoming presidential election will affect this at all? I mean, we know that probably Kamala Harris is coming down in favor of the FTC, and I'm sure Trump has spoken, I think he's spoken out in favor of what Texas has done. So how do you think this will play out, if any, in November or after?
Hard to say. I mean, let's see what happens in November. I am not in the business of predictions, that's for sure.
Hey, well, Professor Joanne Lipman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Charges have been filed in the death of actor Matthew Perry after he allegedly died of a ketamine overdose. Harry Nelson joins us today. He's the founder and managing partner of Nelson Hardiman LLP, and he's the author of the book, The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain. Mr. Nelson, thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
All right, these indictments were brought by the Department of Justice. Is it common for the feds to investigate ketamine overdoses?
Very, very unusual. We've seen, just a little bit of investigation, usually of ketamine in telemedicine settings or other kinds of trafficking. It's super unusual for the feds to be involved in a single patient death like this.
So why do you think they came aboard here?
I think the federal government saw an opportunity to make a statement that would draw public attention to ketamine abuse. I think we've seen that this topic of abuse of popular drugs has been a big issue. We've seen it with ADHD meds over the last couple of years, several very large and ongoing investigations. So I think it was really an opportunity to send a message industry-wide that led the government to pursue this case federally.
So Harry, Perry's personal assistant pled guilty to one count of conspiracy to distribute ketamine causing death. He's accused of performing multiple injections on Perry the day he died. How effectively can he argue that he was merely following his boss's wishes?
Yeah, it's a troubling allegation. Yeah, the injecting with no medical licensing seems just like an absolutely outrageous act, completely irresponsible and far beyond what a personal assistant or even for that matter, like a friend or acquaintance, you know, social acquaintance would do. He involved himself. He chose to involve himself, you know, actively in the administration of the drug. So I think he's got a big problem.
So if he's got a problem because he's not a medical professional, what about the actual medical professionals, the doctors? Two of his doctors were charged. What's your thought there? And how important, to your earlier point, is it for the government to make a point out of going after these kind of abusers, especially ones who were so brazen in their text messages about how they were taking advantage of not only Matthew Perry's addiction, but by overcharging him and calling him what, a moron, I believe the text was. Can you believe how
much? Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, let me just say that first. Anytime a doctor is using such horrific, dehumanizing language and just literally like for trying to figure out how to profit from a patient, that's beyond even imagination and really should disqualify this person from holding a medical license in the first place. But I think what really happened here, the story of this case is that, you know, other more responsible doctors were putting limits on Perry. And unfortunately, our system allowed for Perry and people around him to find permissive doctors who would go beyond the bounds of standard of care, meaning giving him the drug at home to be self-administered, to be given without any medical monitoring. You ask any responsible doctor who's using ketamine in legitimate ways, those are things they would never do. And there were plenty of people in the Los Angeles community who would work with ketamine responsibly, who said no to Perry and led him on the path to these particular doctors.
I've been involved in many other cases involving celebrities and athletes and their drug suppliers, most notably Dr. Conrad Murray, who was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in 2011 for giving Michael Jackson a fatal dose of anesthetic. What is the common thread in each of these cases?
You know, I've been involved in many of these cases and over a dozen major celebrity and sports athletes deaths. I always get contacted by the doctors because I do a lot of work around prescribing and compliance and just sort of resolving crises that come up around it. What the thread that runs through these cases for me is misjudgment by doctors that was just sort of by their being enamored by celebrity and fame and power and going over boundaries that they were very clearly aware of, but decided shouldn't apply. And I think on the patient side, frankly, you know, the patients, there's a certain sense of entitlement in our celebrity culture that led these patients to seek out sort of ways around the rules that apply to everybody else that ended up taking their lives in all of these cases. So I think on both sides of the equation, there's a real misjudgment by the doctors and by the patients that somehow celebrities are different and their privacy, you know, requires this special treatment. But it turns out to be a disaster time after time for both sides.
Harry, I know this is probably hard to quantify, but, you know, do you think that we hear more about these cases only because of the wild nature of the patients? Or do you think it's going on with regular non-famous people? It's just that's not getting as much attention.
I think that there are a lot of cases we're not hearing about. I think there are other form. I think there are a lot of, you know, wealthy people who are willing to, who are able to put the kind of financial incentives in front of doctors to get them to compromise judgment and to be lax about enforcing rules that are supposed to apply. So I do think there's a lot more of this. But at the same time, I do think that there's been a change in general around prescription opioids and other controlled substances over the last 10, 15 years, as doctors have realized that this is the one of the easiest ways for them to lose their license. And I think there's a lot more doctors out there who are concerned and super cautious to the point of not even wanting to touch these drugs, even when they could be helpful. But there's plenty more of the, you know, the cases that make the media are only a fraction of the cases that involve powerful people being treated differently in ways that ends up hurting them.
So, Harry, I mean, these sorts of cases, you know, we've talked a little bit just now about potential ways to reform going forward. There's very rarely a silver bullet, so to speak, a silver bullet solution to try to stem these really tragic cases. What kind of reforms do you think could be particularly helpful here, given that it does seem like there's an acceleration of us hearing about cases and knowing that there are a lot more that we're not hearing about?
You know, first of all, I do think the medical establishment, that professional organizations and doctors should be filling in some of the gaps that are out there and really establishing clear standards. It would be nice if the DEA would do so also. There's a lot of places where we have sort of real, you know, sort of just a very broad outlines of what doctors are supposed to do, but not clear guidance. Ketamine is one of those subjects where, you know, as it's grown in popularity for treating treatment-resistant depression and PTSD and other things, we have not gotten a real clear consensus, you know, put out there by doctors to support each other and drive a consensus view of what's safe in terms of prescribing it, in terms of administering it. And that's true, by the way, of many other drugs and treatments. And I think there's, you know, just a reluctance. In some of the work that we did, I was contacting professional societies, medical societies, and asking for a detailed standard of how should, you know, these different drugs be used for this condition, for treatment-resistant depression. And nobody wants to put statements out there. And I think that's to me the single biggest safeguard. I think this is less about what the government should do and more about what doctors and the medical community should be doing to really make things safer for patients and for doctors in terms of how they practice.
Harry Nelson, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. David Becker is the executive director and founder of the nonpartisan, not-for-profit Center for Election Innovation and Research. We all heard about the harassment of election workers during the 2020 election, and he's working to prevent that from happening in 2024. Mr. Becker, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
David, you're also one of the founders of the Election Official Legal Defense Network. What is that and why did you start it?
Yeah, the Election Official Legal Defense Network is a project of my nonprofit, the Center for Election Innovation and Research. And it's really the brainchild of two giants in the election law field, one Republican and one Democrat, Ben Ginsburg, who served as counsel to Mitt Romney and George W. Bush, and Bob Bauer, who served as counsel to President Obama and President Biden. And the three of us had noted in the aftermath of the 2020 election how election officials, the constituency I work with the most, Republicans and Democrats all over the country, were being targeted for harassment and abuse and threats, not just towards themselves, not just towards their staffs and their facilities, but sometimes even to their families, to their spouses and their children, as a result of lies that were spread about the election. And this put them in very difficult circumstances. Sometimes the abuse and harassment was actually coming from their own county boards, their own county council, their own county law enforcement, who are the ones charged with protecting them. And so we founded the Election Official Legal Defense Network, which you can find at eoldn.org. And what we do is we recruited a network of attorneys all over the country, licensed, qualified attorneys who feel passionately about democracy, people across the political spectrum again. And they stand ready whenever an election official has a request. They submit a request confidentially through the eoldn.org website. And we then pair them with an attorney who's qualified to handle whatever their needs are. And it's what's strange is I often get the question, well, from lawyers, well, I don't know anything about election law. That's not the area I practice in. This is usually not about election law at all. They usually have lawyers that'll help them with whether they have to verify a petition with the right signatures or things like that. This is often because they're experiencing employment harassment. They might need a restraining order against someone. They might be overwhelmed with public records requests that are duplicative and frivolous. And they just need to talk to someone, some lawyer who has their interests at heart and who will give them good advice about what their potential remedies might be. And over the course of the past 3 years now, we're about hitting the 3-year anniversary of founding it. I'm proud to say that we've been able to match all the requests with attorneys to help them. Unfortunately, I'm sad to say that we've seen the number of requests coming in pretty much be steady over that time. And in fact, there's a little bit of an uptick right now.
So, David, Georgia's Republican-controlled election board just voted 3-2 in favor of a new rule, which specifies that county election officials should certify results after reasonable inquiry that the vote count and election results are complete and accurate. What does this mean and what are its implications for the 2024 election?
Well, we've seen a variety of efforts to erode the guardrails of our democracy over the course of the past nearly 46 months. And this is just another piece of that, where there's an effort to try to give the impression that there's a way in which the loser of an election can somehow seize power. The fact is there isn't. What certification is, and I think this is really important, those of us who work in the elections field know this is a very esoteric space. Certification is just the non-discretionary ministerial act of giving an election, giving legal effect to an election. So it's kind of similar. I don't know if any of your listeners play golf, but if you play golf, a professional golfer finishes the round, he has to go to the scorer's table and sign his card. And that's what gives his round effect. But it's not the opportunity for him to go and say, oh, actually, I got a better score on this other hole back an hour ago. And similarly here, certification, that's not what certification is for. Certification just gives the election legal effect. If you have reason to believe that there was a problem with the election that could have affected the outcome, there, of course, is a path for that, a legal path, where the person challenging the election, the candidate challenging that, has to bring evidence. That evidence is going to be scrutinized and cross-examined by a court and reviewed and ultimately ruled upon. And we've seen that in some cases, especially when elections were close, for instance, Florida 2000. But that's not what certification is. Now, I should also say, with regard to certification and these challenges, whether it's at the county level or the state level, these efforts will fail. The winner of the election will have their hand on the Bible on January 20th. These efforts will 100% fail. This is not a strategy designed to succeed. But what it could very well do is give oxygen to lies about the election and lead to more of that harassment of election workers. We've seen election workers followed to and from work as they were counting ballots, pictures taken of their license plates. We've seen election workers being doxxed publicly. We've had election workers who've been texted pictures of their children's school and threatening their children. I mean, this is all things that have actually happened. So anything that erodes these guardrails is bad for that purpose. And I should say, with regard to the Election Official Legal Defense Network, it's one of the ways we can combat that. And for any lawyers listening to that, please go to eoldn.org and volunteer. There's a button right on the homepage, and you can get into our network. And if we ever need you, we'll give you a call.
David, so two of the most prominent victims of the type you're trying to help are Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, who were famously criticized by Rudy Giuliani and others, including President Trump. They won a $146 million defamation judgment against him. Of course, you know, he doesn't have those funds. That's a separate issue. But is that the type of action that your network is looking to assist people with, these kind of lawsuits? And also, what are the challenges, as evidenced in this situation, of trying to actually collect on some of that litigation?
Right. I should just say, I think news just came out in the last hour that Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss have gone to the court today and asked for control of Rudy Giuliani's remaining assets to make sure that they actually are able to collect on that judgment. So ELDN is largely about the safety of election workers and their ability to do their jobs. So most of the work that ELDN does, most of the advice that the lawyers in the ELDN network provide is to prevent continued harassment, to enable them to do their jobs. It's mostly injunctive. It's equitable relief that's being sought. When an election worker requests money damages, thinks they have an affirmative cause of action, and certainly that has been the case. Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss are good examples of that, but there are others who have legitimate causes of action. ELDN is usually not the way, because those services are pro bono, and often, again, for lawyers that are listening, if you bring a case for a lot of money damages to trial and you do all of that work, I think it's entirely appropriate for lawyers to get paid for that kind of work. But sometimes we have paired lawyers with election officials, and if they work out a different arrangement with regard to something that might result in money damages, that's of course entirely fine. The attorney-client relationship is between the election official and the lawyer that we match them with. It's just that if they're asking for injunctive relief, if they're asking for safety and protection, we don't think any election official should ever be out of pocket for that.
So, David, switching gears here, you're a two-time Jeopardy champion and one who wants to be a millionaire. What's your secret sauce for that?
So my secret sauce is, if that happened 25 years ago, still included on your resume or bio so that people will ask about it and think you're still smart, because that was a very long time ago. But back when I was a much younger man, And by the way, this is in the very early days of the internet. So the way they do tryouts and other things for these things now are very different. But I was able to pass the test for both. I got on. I was fortunate. I'll say this for Jeopardy. There is a secret sauce, and the secret sauce is about 99% the buzzer. Yeah. So people will tell you, anyone who's been on, everyone on Jeopardy is smart. And the question is how quickly they can buzz in. Even if you get it wrong, but you're quicker on the buzzer, you're going to be better in the long run. Although I will also say, the 2 days I won on Jeopardy, I was the only one to get Final Jeopardy right. And that
was, remember? That all helps.
I'm sorry?
Remember the question?
Oh, you bet I remember the question. one of them, other people, this is paraphrased, but one of them, a lot of other people have gotten, and the second one, I think I'm the only one that has gotten it right.
Peter, get ready to buzz in. Let's go. Hold on.
Okay. All right, all right. So the category is American buildings. And this building, formerly an art gallery, is now a shrine to the music said to have originated nearby. I can't see the buzzer, but go ahead and just yell it out.
I buzzed in too quick.
Anyone?
I was the buzzer. The shrine to the music. New York Philharmonic? No.
Anyone else? We've got a lot of time on the podcast.
I'm thinking somewhere in Memphis, but I can't think of an art gallery.
Well, the answer.
Carnegie Hall.
Well, I'm sorry?
Carnegie Hall.
No, but you're half right. The second word is hall. It is Preservation Hall in New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
Where jazz was born. The next one, I don't know if we should even bother you. This one I pulled out of some dark, dark place. The category was ballet. This dancer choreographed his first ballet in 1943, I think it was, seeking to incorporate more American themes into ballet.
Baryshnikov.
No.
It's the only ballet dancer I can name. Or Nureyev, one of those guys.
No.
They're too young. Though,
we should not let your listeners wait too much. Like the answer, and again, I pulled this out of some dark, dark recess that I could never replicate. The answer is Jerome Robbins.
Oh,
Ryan Burroughs' favorite. So that's the secret sauce. Be lucky enough to have a question that you can pull out of nowhere and get the right answer.
Executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research and game show superstar, David Becker. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks to all of you. This is great.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined once again by Rachel Fizay, co-founder and managing partner of ZFZ LLP. I've seen her pop up on News Nation, the BBC, and other places. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we have Simon Kashishan, a licensed attorney in Washington, D.C. and Texas, and the vice president of risk management at Red Bull. Simon, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Simon, how many Red Bulls so far today?
Today, none, because I'm not in the office. The office is where the Red Bull is at, not in my house.
You'll both be happy to know that for your episode, Trump Watch is back in the top spot. After a brief hiatus, this is where Rich purges all the Trump legal issues from the last time we talked. Rich, where are we going today? Arlington Cemetery photos, hush money sentencing, DC election fraud case. Where are you taking this thing?
Yeah, those are all good. I mean, the Arlington is still growing. I mean, there might be criminal charges, although I think the woman who was allegedly assaulted said she's not pursuing it. But the big story legally this week is that, Jack Smith filed a superseding indictment on the election fraud charges in which, Tina, listen, Jack Smith is a smart guy, lots of resources, but basically just whited out the name president and put in candidate many times, which, you know, of course, he had to do to meet the Supreme Court decision that ruled back in July that presidents have immunity for official acts. So what Jack Smith did here is he took out anything that could be deemed as an official act by the president and anything that was an act by someone running for president, which several allegations in this superseding indictment are, mean that he wasn't acting in official capacity. Therefore, he is not immune from prosecution. This was expected, of course, as soon as the Supreme Court ruled in that 6-3 decision. Of course, Trump has now moved for a continuance. He wants this, as we've talked about extensively, to be delayed until after the election. Of course, if he is elected president, he will likely fire Jack Smith and not pursue this case at all, obviously. But what are your thoughts on this new superseding indictment?
Well, as you said, Rich, it was to be expected. I'm envisioning, Jack Smith sitting there with a bottle of Whiteout for those of us who are old enough to remember that, before computers became the way to do things. I think that Trump's going to find a way to, skirt past this, whether it's getting a continuance or whatnot. And my guess is that he will leverage this, as he often does, into the narrative you know, that he's being wrongfully persecuted. So I don't hold out any real hope that this is going to go in a meaningful direction, especially before the election.
Rachel, do you think that the Supreme Court decision was at least crafted, even though it was written by a conservative majority, do you think it was written in a way that gave Jack Smith a blueprint to write the superseding indictment the way he wrote it?
I don't think it was written in a way to give him a blueprint, but I do think that the Supreme Court had to stop short of saying any actions during a presidency cannot be criminal. And so that's what Jack Smith has kind of glommed onto, and he's holding on to the fact that as a candidate, you are not acting in your presidential capacity. The shorter the indictment is here, and the reason it's shorter is because they've taken out all of those DOJ acts and the conspiracy that was alleged between Jeffrey Clark at the DOJ and Trump, because that would lead the court to believe that that was acting as president in an official capacity. But as a candidate running for president, you certainly can commit crimes. So it is interesting that he is attempting to skirt around this, and we'll have to see what happens. But I agree with Tina. It'll be nothing until after the election.
Yeah, Simon, I mean, listen, this is a new indictment, so that results in new legal issues, new legal challenges, very importantly, that will, of course, ultimately make its way to the Supreme Court. None of that will be done before there is a new president elected in November, right? Any chance that there will be?
No, I mean, when we talk about going through the federal court system, my recollection, not that I practice a lot of criminal law and I'm not really involved in the space, I don't remember it ever being a quick process. And it really does open up the door to Trump's legal team to challenge the details through many of the different levels. And so there's really no chance it's ever going to see the light of day before the November election. However, it's really interesting to see what will happen. I think depending on the outcome of the election, we might see this continue on, or it might just sort of die, like you sort of referenced, because there's a good chance that somebody will get fired very quickly.
Anyone thinks it moves the needle politically? I mean, is any is any voter out there who was undecided, that small sliver of people that might be undecided, look at this and say, wow, I'm now convinced that I'm going to vote for Kamala over Trump? There's no way, right?
No, I don't think so. I think the narrative for those people that are Trump supporters is going to be that, you know, he's being singled out, and this is the usual lawyering that takes place where somebody just basically, we talk about White House, drops off a couple of pages of the indictment and does whatever they can to try to stick it to him again. On the other hand, this is sort of the card that he was dealt, and he had to sort of retune the pleadings in order to be able to move forward with the case. And so this is what good lawyering is about. It's also what a lot of times the general public feels that makes lawyers sort of not nice people, because we're always looking for the angles. And so this is probably not going to change anybody's mind.
Moving along, your LFO word of the day is demure. It means reserved, modest, shy. It's an adjective. It's popular among the cool kids. And Tina, a cool kid who coined the phrase on TikTok, now knows what the word trademarking means as well.
So Ryan Jules LeBron, who is a well-known TikTok influencer with over 2 million followers, has become best known for her advice on exactly what you just said, how to be demure, mindful, and cutesy. She became an overnight sensation, with many well-known celebrities and brands working with her on sponsored content and promoting this phrase. But as we've seen often on Legal Face-Off, along with fame and fortune comes some sort of a legal dispute, this time a trademark dispute, because it looks like someone else, that someone being Jefferson Bates, has beat Jules to filing for trademarking the phrase very demure, very mindful, in what appears to be an attempt to cash in on LeBron's success. So in comes the founder of the social media platform Hive Social to try to help the situation by filing a trademark application for very demure, very cutesy, which she says she'll assign to LeBron as the rightful owner of the phrase. Being a trademark lawyer myself, I'm not really quite sure how that helps the situation. There are a bunch of people coming out of the woodwork here trying to advise LeBron on what to do. As a trademark lawyer, I can advise her that if I were her, I'd first start by making sure that she's not infringing anybody else's rights by using cutesy and demure, because it's one thing to use them in conversation and it's another to use them on merchandise and a brand. Assuming she's not infringing on anyone else's rights, she should really start thinking about going after others who are trying to capitalize off her brand. I did a little bit of sleuthing here on Jefferson Bates, and it looks like he's filed some other trademark applications in the past, Rich, trying to do the same thing that he's doing here. For example, he's tried to get a trademark registration for the phrase "Go Broncos, let's ride," which got rejected. So this shows what could very well be bad faith here. And so I would tell LeBron to go ahead and start with a cease and desist letter, look into objecting to the application that's been filed with the trademark office, and potentially look at suing if those are not satisfactory remedies, Rich. I like your cutesy Lenkoff, by the way.
Yeah, it's not as good as Simon's, but that's I'm
I would say something, but I'm being demure. I'm being demure. I'm not going to say anything.
I mean, 10 million views. Like, what are we doing wrong as a podcast? We got here's what I'm coming up with. I looked at some synonyms for these words, and I'm going to now put out there that my new catchphrase is I'm being prissy and diffident. Prissy and diffident is the new one. We're going with prissy and diffident. You know, no trademark for me, and let's spread the word.
I do insurance work a lot of times, Rich, and I just like my favorite one is, well, I'll come back to you. I'm off topic.
Rachel, what do you think of this? I mean, the question is, and it's a really interesting legal question, should the first to trademark or first to use be the one that profits off demure and cutesy?
First to use should be the one that profits. The fact that she claimed she didn't really know what she was doing here, she just came up with this. It was a sensation. That's how our days are working now with YouTubers and what catches on. We'll see how prissy and diffident does. But I think first to use, she has a very strong basis. A cease and desist should put him on notice, and then she can go on. So the whole point of intellectual property law is to reward the people that came up with the intellectual property. And so that she has the better case, but of course it's going to cost her money. And it's going to be a legal battle, and it just kind of stinks for everybody.
I love the fact that this is now intellectual property. I mean, this ain't exactly Moby Dick. Let's face it. But yeah, it's a valuable IP now that this person came up with these two words. Simon?
Well, the upside, I think, is that there's probably more people following the story. And at the end of the day, she's getting more followers. But this serves as a cautionary tale, I guess, for all content creators, and highlights sort of the complexities of social media trends and intellectual property law. And this is sort of one of these things, when you're still trying to get your come up, it's hard to invest and take steps to protect whatever it is that you're trying to protect. But once you're there, there's other people coming after you. And at the end of the day, it's going to cost money. And I think I think we're all sort of aligned that she'll probably get her rights. But when I do my social media, I too am going to be mindful of, and now I'm going to tell you what my insurance word is, recalcitrance. I'm going to be the Mr. Recalcitrant.
By the way, Simon, I give you kudos for the remarkable organization of that old-fashioned mail sorter over your shoulder there. You have no building or either that, or you're the proprietor of like a 19th century hotel and there's not that many assets.
This is my digital scanner, so I don't use it that often anymore, but it's right here on my desk. It's ready to go at any time. I know you're impressed with my leveraging technology. Moving on.
What are the two things on either end of that letter thing? Is that those are pending bills you just don't want to deal with?
No, yeah, those are just things
that legal bills on the shelf. No wonder my legal bills aren't getting paid. They're in that
right there. That's your bill right there. That's right. Next to the certified mail piece from back in the day. I think they're electronic now too, but you never.
Who's your abacus?
You know, wait, hold on. I'll be back.
Rachel, I like your flowers, by the way, and you've got a good setup as well. You're on point with everything. Let's move along here. Well, in Nevada, a politician's now accused of killing a journalist, and what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. Rich, this is grabbing some national headlines.
Well, not accused, convicted, and sentenced to life. By the way, I was impressed, Rachel, with how quickly the sentencing was done. Usually there's a period of a couple months. I mean, this guy was convicted on Wednesday and I believe sentenced to life on Thursday. They don't mess around Nevada. Not a lot of time for contemplation or impact statements. But yeah, this is a high profile case. This was a local politician in Vegas who was now, as I said, convicted of murdering a journalist from the local newspaper in Vegas who had uncovered. He had written articles that exposed this person of harassment and misconduct. And then he was murdered by this elected official. The trial lasted 2 weeks. Among the evidence, Tina, that the jurors were convinced by was lots of DNA. There was this famous straw hat that a perpetrator was seen on video wearing as he left the house. Just turns out that this individual who was convicted had a similar straw hat that was a really, you know, noticeable hat cut up in his house. And most notably, from my perspective, there was video of this guy, the murderer, getting into his garage with cameras all around, by the way, wearing a full white jumpsuit, like a Breaking Bad style jumpsuit. You know, we've covered some dumb criminals in the past, but maybe don't wear the Heisenberg, you know, suit if you're walking in front of a group of reporters after you just killed someone. But, yes, like I said, sentenced to life and, you know, up until the end, he was saying his defense was that this was a frame job. He was framed.
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy. I mean, as you've said, we've covered some crazy stories on this show, but there are so many missteps here, especially if the ultimate objective is to successfully kill somebody. I mean, it was just outrageous. And living in an internet world, living in a world where people have cameras everywhere all the time that are rolling 24/7, it's just preposterous.
Yeah, Simon, the idea that, you know, these articles that were, of course, damaging, but that would lead to someone stalking and killing the reporter, I mean, that blows your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what a Democratic administrator does in Clark County, but I'm pretty sure I wouldn't kill for that job. I will just say that.
Yeah, Rachel, what are your thoughts on this one?
I think it's terribly sad, and it's all amateur. So it sounds like he was an incompetent. He was running his office incompetently. And that was coming out. And for some reason, he thought killing the reporter who had published stories on him would go unnoticed. I mean, in the kind of blatant manner that this all went down. It's horribly sad that someone was murdered doing their job, working for the people. And that's the truth. And it's even sadder that it's an official that's doing this.
You don't want to blame politics too much, but look, I mean, the narrative here fits in with the attacking of the press that we've seen over the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't think of this story without knowing that, right? That the press, the media, who do, you know, incredible work. Many of the things that we enjoy these days wouldn't be around without freedom of the press and the attack on the press by many, including, of course, Trump for 4 years and continues, leads to this culture, in my opinion. So I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree. And it's not something we, until recent years, have thought of as much at the forefront of being part of our fabric, whereas you do think of this happening in other countries. So this is where we are right now, but it is horribly sad. It feels like such a waste of a life.
All right, digging deeper into the bag, cyber squatting can lead to big bucks if you're patient enough. Tina, tell us about this New York trademark lawyer who hit it big in the 2024 election.
Brian, as a trademark lawyer, I cannot say that I encourage anybody to become a cyber squatter, but this trademark lawyer fancies himself as the best political cyber squatter ever. So Jeremy Green-Esch buys and sells domain names when he isn't practicing law and just sold the domain name harriswaltz.com to a supporter of Vice President Kamala Harris for $15,000. So this Harris reporter who bought the domain name was a man who prefers not to be identified, who bought it because he didn't want the Trump campaign to buy the domain name. The website currently redirects visitors to Kamala Harris's website. So Jeremy initially paid only $8.99 for this domain back in 2020. He apparently bought 15 variations of Kamala Harris domain names, combining Harris's name with what he called every sort of folksy white man he could think of who was big at the time. So he apparently now owns about 60 domains that include both Democratic and Republican potential candidates, including a bunch of Gretchen Whitmer domains who he thinks has a pretty good chance in 2028. He has a track record of success, or at least success by his standards. Back in 2016, he sold the ClintonCain.com domain name for $15,000 to an anonymous buyer who apparently turned out to be a campaign worker for former President Donald Trump. That domain ended up being used to point to a website to post negative news about the Democratic candidates. He apparently sells domain names through his marketplace that he created for registered trademarks called Communer. For what it's worth, you listeners out there, don't try this at home. What Esch is doing can easily fall into the breaking the law territory. There is such a thing as a federal law known as the ACPA, which is the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act that makes this practice known as cyber squatting illegal. So just because someone doesn't take you to court doesn't mean that they can't take you to court. So again, I mean, Rich, this is just another one of those crazy stories of, you know, people doing crazy things. I would not do this in a million years, especially as a trademark lawyer.
I feel like the domain names that didn't quite pan out, like, you know, Harris Whitmer or Harris Newsom, they should be donated to developing countries. Like, you know, you give the hat, the Super Bowl loser hat that was made. Like, you know, there's somewhere where people are wearing Buffalo Bills Super Bowl winner hats. You should donate these domain names to them. But yeah, I mean, don't break the law. But on the other hand, it's pretty entrepreneurial. It's a pretty good return. $8, 15 grand, Rachel.
Pretty good return. I don't know how long he had to research every feasible white Midwestern male, but it sounds like he took the time to do it. It sounds like this guy has some hobbies that he's pretty excited about when they pay off. So the only thing I can say on this, which kind of harkens back to cutesy and demure, is this is somebody profiting again off of other people's kind of hard work. So in the case of Clinton Kane, he sells that to a Trump supporter. Like, that's terrible. And then they use that domain name against them. And I think that's not how this is meant to play out. But again, people are creative in thinking of how they can buy and sell intellectual property or ideas or, you know, other things that are out there less tangible.
Would be interesting to know how many combinations he bought, Whitmer's, Buttigieg, Newsom, Pritzker, whatever, to get to that point, to hit the jackpot on this one, I guess. Well, we've been following this just horrible story out of Italy of the capsized yacht that killed 7 people, including some pretty high profile people in the tech finance industries. It happened in the middle of some severe weather. And Tina, now it sounds like a legal storm is brewing for the captain.
This is just a horrible story. The most recent developments are that there are now 3 members of the crew, including the captain, who are under investigation for manslaughter after 7 people were killed when the Bajan super yacht sank in a storm while anchored off the coast of Sicily on August 19. The storm was suspected to be potentially a downspout. British technology tycoon Mike Lynch, his daughter Hannah, and 5 others were killed, including the yacht's chef, the Morgan Stanley International Chairman Jonathan Bloomer and his wife. Clifford Chance lawyer Chris Morvillo and his wife were also killed. This 184-foot yacht capsized and sank within minutes. The trip was intended to be a celebration after Lynch was acquitted in a decades-long $11 billion fraud case. So the boat's captain, James Cutfield, was put under investigation earlier this week for manslaughter and shipwreck. He's chosen to remain silent in the wake of prosecutor and press inquiries. A couple of days ago, it was reported that ship engineer Tim Parker Eaton and sailor Matthew Griffith are also being investigated for the same crimes. Parker Eaton is suspected of having failed to protect the yacht's engine room and operating systems while Griffith was on watch duty the night of the incident. Naval marine experts say that they find this tragedy very puzzling. Unfortunately, they say vessels like this, built by the Italian high-end yacht manufacturer Perini, are considered unsinkable. We know other boats in history, including the Titanic, were called unsinkable. But these experts do say that this yacht should have withstood the storm, or at least not sunk as quickly as it did. The chief prosecutor on this said his team is going to consider each possible element of responsibility, including the captain, the crew, and individuals who are in charge of supervision in the yacht's manufacturer. They first have to salvage the wreck, which is about 170 feet down, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from a legal perspective, it's really interesting. This was, by all accounts, a freak storm, you know, like a once-in-a-lifetime type of storm. There's been some allegations that I was reading about today that the crew was partying. There might have been some drinking involved earlier. But, you know, obviously the defense will be that this was out of their control, right? That they can't be responsible for an act of God like this. They are responsible for certain types of weather, obviously ones you can predict. But they will argue that this was beyond that. Now, to the extent that the prosecutors and ultimately civilly, because there'll be lots of civil lawsuits coming from this, to the extent that they can prove that they should have anticipated this and acted differently. Even though you can't anticipate it, the argument will be, once the storm hit, how did you act? That's really the key. I don't know. We know that from, you know, prior cases with Italy. You know, the legal system certainly different. I don't think that people enjoy the same types of freedoms that they do in our system to that extent. So we'll see. But lots of criminal charges, I think, that will be brought, especially, Simon, given the high profile nature of the decedents. We just talked to an expert who pointed out that in the Matthew Perry case, the reason the prosecutors are bringing that case is because of the fame and notoriety of Matthew Perry. Similarly, you would think that a country that relies on tourism and that has a very robust sailing community and boating community would seek to prosecute this, partially because of the high profile nature of it and the people involved.
For sure. This is politicized, and there's no question in my mind that the Italian authorities are going to prosecute this. But the thing that I think that I look at, and as you know, I do a lot of insurance related stuff and civil matters. One of the things that I think has come up time and again, notwithstanding the fact that this might have been an act of God or a once in a lifetime storm, is that they should have had time to rescue. And the question as to whether they were potentially partying or there was something else going on or they didn't have adequate measures in place. I think the negligent rescue or the negligent respond to the incident is really what's going to carry the day in the civil claim. And although I'm not as familiar with Italian laws, I'm sure that there will be suits filed all over the place, especially if there was I think there were UK citizens and so on and so forth. So I suspect that would be the focus of the civil case. In terms of the criminal one, the interesting thing about this is I think the yacht owner is the one that's responsible for removing the wreckage from the floor of the ocean. And so it's not something that the Italian authorities are going to do. And so the cost associated that with that, according to maritime law, is on the owner. And so that is something that may or may not take place in due course. And I think there's more to come.
All right, moving along to the next topic. This is the biggest nightmare for anyone with a teenager. An 18-year-old was killed in Michigan after his friend crashed the car they were in. They were doing over 100 miles an hour. Now the mom of the dead teenager is suing the mom of the driver. Rich, explain this one for us.
Interesting. I mean, we've covered and we've seen a trend legally of not just the perpetrators of crime, like in this case and like in many school shootings that we've seen being prosecuted and also being pursued civilly. The trend is that the parents of these individuals are also being pursued and successfully. Lately, we saw in the Crumbly case, Tina, where James and Jennifer Crumbly, the parents of Ethan Crumbly, who shot up and killed four students in Oxford, Michigan, they were found guilty and sentenced to 10 years in prison because the jury found that they could have prevented the shooting by, you know, doing several things differently. Similarly, in this case, the allegation is that just like handing your child a gun or not supervising the gun, they handed this troubled individual, and there's lots of, you know, evidence that he was really troubled. They handed him a lethal weapon in a high-speed car. And that resulted in him driving that car at an incredibly unsafe speed and killing this individual. So I think it has a lot of legs. I think it's a it's something that should be pursued. Again, there's lots of evidence that this mom was texting her son, not while he was driving, but texting him after following him on the app and saying, slow down, you're out of control, like literally saying words, slow the F down right now. He had been driving 123 in their Audi. She bought herself a BMW that could go 177 miles per hour, right? So if I'm the attorney, if I'm the prosecutor, I'm telling the jury there's this culture of speeding that the mom and the parents were just supporting. So I think it's an easier case than many of the school shooting cases, actually. So I think there's a lot of merit to it, actually.
Agree with you, Rich, that when you look at the evidence, at least in the Crumbly case, with respect to, you know, everything that happened there, I think the evidence here really leads a lot more directly to the ultimate tragedy that occurred by virtue of the fact that the parents, who was on notice, it seemed like this kid was upping the ante every time he got behind the wheel. And his mother, it sounds like, was a witness to this, knew that he was dangerous, asked him to slow down, presumably because she realized that he was a danger, but she didn't do anything to keep the keys away from him or the car away from him. And so I agree with you that in at least certain ways, this case appears to have more legs than the school shootings.
Rachel, you want to take the opposite perspective, that this is a if they do charge him, this is prosecutorial overreach, and that this is really seeking other people responsible for what is, in essence, an individual who sped, who caused this person's death?
Yeah. So I think in a civil case, it definitely has legs. I think this is something a jury can get behind. And I think the evidence is going to be lengthy. Even what's already come out is lengthy. The parents knew, 16-year-old boy, he had a lot of basic issues, both with his mom. He'd been, they'd called domestic violence for actions he'd committed against his mom. This was, for lack of a better term, like an out of control kid that seems incredibly entitled, incredibly spoiled, and had incredible access to dangerous activities, including speed driving. So I think civilly, this case could work. I think beyond a reasonable doubt, if it's charged criminally, I think it's much more difficult to show than even a school shooting case, because giving somebody a car is different than giving somebody a gun when you think of criminal activity. Allowing access to a gun, guns have essentially one purpose, and that is to shoot, and they are always lethal. A car is not for the purpose of an inherently dangerous activity. So I think that's where it will turn as far as any kind of criminal liability. It may turn there as far as civil liability, but I think that there can be a very compelling argument made that it's more likely than not that the parents should be at fault for this.
Simon, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, look, from a civil standpoint, I think it's pretty straightforward. The kid was probably insured under the policy anyway. And so if they have excess, the insurance company is going to be involved. From the parents' perspective, the argument is not only did they give the instrumentality that gave rise to the injury, which was this super fast car, but they also, one of the things in the article, I think, referred to them having a Subaru in the garage as well. And she gave him access to the BMW that goes 177 miles an hour. I don't know that it made that much of a difference, but the allegations, other than the kid being an insured himself, is obviously derivative negligence on the part of the mother. Potentially negligent supervision, negligent entrustment, all these types of derivative negligence claims. But I think there are some defenses that can be raised, both if this is being prosecuted criminally and or in the civil case. It's not like she wasn't monitoring this kid's behavior. She had GPS tracking on him. She was checking his speed. She was telling him not to speed, and she was trying to assert control over him. Now, whether hiding the keys would have worked or not, there's probably more facts. But this is a messy one. I think, again, it's a pretty straight forward argument in the civil arena. Not sure whether or not, for the same reasons, the criminal action, if it were to be presented by a prosecutor, would be successful.
All right, two pretty heavy stories there. Let's go a little lighter. I didn't know that J-Lo was using Ben Affleck's name when they got married. But Rich, I guess that doesn't matter anymore, does it?
Yeah, the one thing that she is asking for in their split is to have her name back. Considerable assets on both sides, obviously. They acquired some of that in the 2 or 3 years they were married. So under California laws, our guest knows that is split. But the one thing that will not be split anymore is their name, Tina. And she'll go back to being the famed J-Lo, Jenny from the Block. Are you devastated by the breakup? And do you support dropping Affleck in favor of Lopez?
Well, I mean, I think that she absolutely should drop his name, especially because they're not going to be together anymore. And they weren't married all that long. And I think it's a very personal decision, Rich. I have many of my friends who kept their maiden names. I mean, I kept my maiden name. I've got other friends who gotten married, and depending on how long they were married, even if it ended up in divorce, they've still kept their husband's name, so, or their ex-husband's name. So I think it's a very personal thing. And as for the relationship, I am sad for them because it was quite the story to have been together like over 20 years ago, to have broken up, to have had separate lives, essentially children with other folks, and then to come back together. It was a very fairy tale narrative. And it's sad because, you know, it sounds like, from at least what I've read, that she didn't want to get divorced. But it's one of those things, Rich, where I think we're all old enough to know that it's hard for people to change, especially when you get to a certain age. So, you know, to think that someone's going to change at this stage in the game, if that's what you're looking for, the likelihood that, you know, you will end up getting what you want, that, and if it's dependent on that person changing, it's probably pretty unlikely it's going to happen.
Now, Rachel, I think Affleck's already moved on. There's rumors that he's dating a Kennedy? I think the daughter of RFK Jr. But we're going to end off our segment here with asking you and Simon and then the rest. This is, you know, many people's favorite celebrity couple. Do you have an all-time favorite celebrity couple that is not hyphenated as Ben Lo? Now, what was there? They were Jen? What were they again?
Bennifer?
Jennifer, correct. What celebrity couple is your all-time favorite? Start with you, Rachel.
Steffi Graf and Andre Agassi. They are my favorite.
Good power couple right there. Still together or no? I think they're still together.
Still together. Their kids are not tennis players. I think they are star athletes in any other sport they've chosen. But kind of under the radar, do a lot of charity work. And I've always liked both of them as tennis players, being a former tennis player myself. So,
by Agassi. Ryan Burrow, favorite all-time celeb couple. And feel free to abbreviate them if you'd like.
I have to tell you, I think right now at this moment, Dansby and Mallory Swanson.
You might explain that to our non-Cub fan who they are.
Oh, okay. Shortstop for the Chicago Cubs and striker for the Team USA women's gold medal winning soccer team.
Yes. And Swanson did not travel to Paris to see her win because he's that devoted a baseball player. That's true. All right. That's a good one. Kashishian. Now, by the way, you've got a name that I would drop in a second. I mean, I know you're happily married, but for Christ's sake, I mean, come on.
Once or twice I was mixed up with Kardashian when somebody was trying to spell my name, and that didn't really, once they looked up, they were not impressed with who was presented to them. You know, I'm not really following a lot of celebrity couples, but I do like Jay-Z and Beyonce, so I'll make up one. Jay-Zonce is what I'm going with.
Nothing. Maybe the most, they got to be the richest power couple of all time, right? Maybe Prince Harry and Meghan surpass them, but I don't know. I think Beyonce and...
They're doing all right.
Tina, favorite celeb couple of all time?
I have two. I'm happy to share both, but the first one that comes to mind is Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson.
Oh, what movie did they meet on?
You know, I know that they were, I don't remember, they were together in Sleepless in Seattle, but I think they were together before that.
Volunteers. Little known.
Wow. What year was that?
It was like early Hanks. All right. Who's the second one?
Oh my God, it disappeared. I had it and then it disappeared.
All right. We'll come back.
I'm going to have to think about that. I had it on the top. Oh, wait a minute. No, I forgot. I'll tell you later.
Who you got?
I like Goldie and Kurt Russell.
Oh, still surviving. After all these years. Oh, technically never married, I believe. Right.
Yeah.
Partners. My favorite I thought Ryan was going to steal mine, but mine's also a Chicago power couple in the athletic space. Ryan, can you guess who I'm talking about?
You're not going Pippen Jordan route, are you? No,
also a gold medalist, Simon Biles and Owens from the Bears, who did, by the way, leave training camp, as we saw on Hard Knocks, to go visit Simon Biles, the GOAT gymnast in Paris. So he supported her. So who knows? Maybe Swanson will no longer be a power couple because he didn't go root on his wife in Paris.
I think they'll
be. Remembered my other one, Michael J. Fox and Tracy Pollan.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Sit, Ubu, sit. Good dog.
Good dog. Woof.
All right, let's wrap this up. Thank you so much, Rachel Fize and Simon Kashishian. If we're going by, wait, Demir Shishan is the name he's going by.
Literally left out a third of his name, though.
That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Faceoff on WGN. Special thanks to Yale lecturer Joanne Lippman, Harry Nelson from Nelson Hardiman LLP, and David Becker, with the executive director and founder of the nonpartisan not-for-profit Center for Election Innovation and Research. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegel. For Tina Martini, Cutesy Lenkoff. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Cutesy Lenkoff. We're seeing something else. I forget.
I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question? Just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.